Good morning. I'll try to talk fast so we can make it some time here. My name is Teresa Bird, and for the last 20 years I was at the University of Texas School of Public Health until June. I just moved to the Texas Tech Paul L. Foster School of Medicine in the same city, so I haven't had to leave El Paso, Texas, which is a place that I consider home after I've been there for so many years, and I have no relationships to disclose. I want to talk to you today about a project that's called Project Amigas, which stands for Ayudando a las Mujeres con Información, Guía y Amor para su Salud. And this is a project that has been part of my life for many years. And one of my students who worked with me on the original project is here, Andrea Heckert. And what year did we finish that original development? 2002. So this has been a long-term project, and I think it's kind of nice for people who are interested in getting into research or interested in seeing how this might progress, because this is the first time that I've had a project where I've followed through with my CDC colleagues for all this time. And so it's been kind of an amazing journey. We're in El Paso, Texas, and whenever we talk about El Paso, my colleagues, even in Texas, say things like, isn't that just kind of like a little bitty place? And they think we still ride horses, and, you know, no. El Paso is actually a very large metropolitan area, about 800,000 in El Paso, I think it's up to about 200,000 maybe in Las Cruces, which is the next city very close to us in New Mexico, and probably a couple of million in Ciudad Juarez. So we're a very large community, and we do have flush toilets, and we don't ride horses. Well, except for if we have a horse and we want to ride it out in the country. So I want to go through the whole development of Amigas really quickly. Amigas Phase 1 was the development of the original Amigas intervention, and we developed this intervention using a process called intervention mapping, which I'm sure some of you have heard about. We gathered data at that time using 13 focus groups with women in the El Paso community who are in our priority population, in other words, low-income women, mostly of Mexican origin. And we did 500, this is hard to believe, but we did 550 door-to-door surveys. I still can't believe we did that. But we collected just tons and tons of data on various sort of correlates of getting pap smear screening. And we used several different theories, the health belief model, social cognitive theory, the theory of planned behavior. So we just did all kinds of data collection. And once we had the data collected and analyzed, and that's, you know, that was a long time ago, we started the development of the intervention. And we did that using intervention mapping, and we included in our development people from the community, promotoras de salud, physicians, other kinds of healthcare providers, as well as students at the School of Public Health. So we had a number of people who were giving us input into the matrices as we developed those matrices that you use in intervention mapping. And we really do believe that having all of that input was one of the things that kind of made Amigas one of the better interventions, I think, around. So we completed that in 2002. And then they changed the screening guidelines, which is always sort of a shocker. You know, we had developed this intervention that included a video, a novela, and flip charts and a promotora training guide, and we were all ready to launch. And actually, I'll never forget this because Andrea, I believe, went to the American Cancer Society meeting. It was a Hispanic a summit, I think. And she was presenting our original Amigas, and somebody at the summit stood up and said, "Oh, did you know they changed the guidelines yesterday?" I was just like, "Oh, great." So Amigas Phase 2 was CDC contacted me, and they paid, by the way, CDC paid for the development of Amigas, and they contacted me and they said, "You know, we really want to redevelop and work a little bit on Amigas." And so we got together some more community health workers. So we found promotoras de salud from San Diego, from Yakima, Washington, from El Paso, and I believe there were some people from Hood River, Oregon. And we started meeting together with Battelle and CDC. We met for a year, and we redeveloped Amigas. The first thing we did was to develop it so that it was also in English, because when we developed Amigas, it was just in Spanish. So we added an English piece. We upgraded a little bit the information because of the change in guidelines, which, by the way, has changed twice again since we started. So we worked very hard to redevelop Amigas. We added some things. We added some games, and we added some other elements. One of the most important things that we added, as far as I can tell, was something called Mi Promesa, which was a very pretty sort of certificate that at the end of the intervention, women would promise to themselves something, either that they would think about getting screened or that they would get screened, and they put it on the refrigerator. It had a rose. It was very pretty. And when we talked to women, that was one of the things they liked best about this. It seems like a very simple thing, but that's what they liked. So then comes Amigas Phase 3, which is a randomized controlled trial of this project to test it for efficacy. And you can see there were a bunch of us working on this. I was the principal investigator, and my co-principal investigator is Maria Fernandez, and I'm sure many of you in Latino Caucus know Maria. Maru Fernandez Esquer, Sally Vernon, Melchor Ortiz, Dave Larson, Gloria Coronado, and Betty Thompson. And then we had two CDC investigators, Kathy Wilson and Judith Lee Smith. And at this point, several RAs who were students at the School of Public Health who worked with us on the project, Maribel, Daisy, and Ben Ali. This is the toolbox, the Amigas toolbox, and it includes, and it's very simple to put together. We wanted this to be something that people could actually obtain and use. And so it's all things that can be downloaded and used. So there's a video, the novela, which is called Una Amistad Saludable. And it's a novela that includes two young women in Andrea's bedroom when we filmed it. We used actors from the community rather than professional actors, so it was people who were from the community we were trying to reach. It involved two young women talking about getting ready to go out on a date, their mother, who is a promotora, who kind of talks to them about sexual health, and their grandmother, who's shocked that anybody would be talking about this, but who also has not been screened. So we tried to reach all generations with the video. There's a flip chart. There's some anatomical charts that were developed with the help of the women in the community that made them easier for the women to understand where things were in their bodies. And then there's some game cards, and you can see Mi Promesa is right there on the top. So this is the toolkit. This was a promotora-delivered intervention. So our aims in Phase 3 were first to assess the efficacy of Amigas for increasing cervical cancer screening among urban, rural, and border women of Mexican origin. Now, it wasn't our choice to choose only women of Mexican origin. That was CDC's choice. And that made it a little more difficult to recruit in Houston, because a lot of the women we recruited or tried to recruit turned out to not be of Mexican origin. So we really had to work hard to find those particular women. But we do believe that this intervention was not developed only for women of Mexican origin. So we think it's useful for Latinas in different groups. And the second was to characterize the relative effectiveness of the major components of the intervention. So I'll show you how we did that. And then third was to conduct a process evaluation to ensure appropriate delivery of the intervention. And the fourth was to conduct a cost-effectiveness analysis of the intervention, which is, by the way, still being analyzed. So we conducted the trial in Houston, which was our urban setting, in El Paso, which was our border setting, and in Yakima Valley, which was a rural farm worker community. Women were randomly allocated. The inclusion criteria were that they had to be women who had not had a Pap test in the last 3 years, so they were non-compliant or non-adherent to guidelines. And so they were, once they were pre-screened, they were randomly allocated to one of four arms. So there was a control arm, which was just usual care, no intervention. But what we did with those women was after the end of the trial, we went back and delivered the MES program to them for ethical reasons. And then we had women in the full MES program. They got everything. We had women in the MES movie without the flip chart, but everything else. And MES with the flip chart, but no movie. And everything else. I think I got that right. So there were four arms, and we originally we were supposed to randomize 150 women to each arm, and we over sampled, but we still ended up with a little bit fewer than 150 in each arm. It was about 135 average in each arm. So we completed our final data collection in March. One of the things that we wanted to do was, rather than just use self-report of Pap tests, we wanted to actually look at medical records. So here's the kicker. we made arrangements with all the clinics. We had the women sign HIPAA forms. You know, everything was in order. But when it came right down to it, we couldn't get the clinics in general to give us the information, which was really kind of irritating. we only got information on about a third of the women. So that was kind of difficult. So we did analyze this based on self-report because we just didn't have enough clinic data. For the 132 records that we got from clinics, it was a little bit better than what we see in the literature as far as agreement. So 77% of women who reported having a Pap test, we actually found that in their medical records for this 132. So in the literature, it's more around 68%. So we were doing a little bit better. And we also believe that some of those women probably did have Pap tests, but they may not have remembered where they went or they had their records lost. Some of them went to Ciudad Juarez to have their Pap tests, and we really had a hard time getting those records. So in the end, what we found was if you look at overall, there was quite a difference, and it was highly statistically significant between any intervention and no intervention. And that was true in all the sites except for Houston, where it looks like there was a difference, but it was not statistically significant. It was like approaching significance, but, or as one of my statisticians says, you know, avoiding significance. We don't know which. And we're not sure why that was. But in general, it was very different. And so, for instance, in El Paso, in the control group, only 28% of those women, after six-month follow-up from the intervention, had received a Pap test, whereas in the intervention group, 62.5% had received a Pap test. So we felt really good about this. But in order to be really as conservative as possible, we also did a different analysis, which some folks in my group wanted to call intent to treat. I don't think it's an intent to treat analysis, so I call it a conservative analysis. And in that case, we did an analysis. We lost some women to follow-up, and so we looked at those women as if they had not had a Pap test. So we made an assumption that everyone who was lost to follow-up did not have a Pap test, which, of course, some of them sure did. But when we did that analysis, we still had a significant difference. And so that made us feel really good about what we had done, because we feel that even with the most conservative statistics, there's a difference between the intervention and a non-intervention. So this is 6 months after intervention. So we found that the intervention was effective for increasing self-reported Pap test screening in women of Mexican origin, but we didn't find a difference between the three different intervention groups. So, you know, it looked like any of the interventions were pretty much the same, no matter what we left out. The limitations were, this was based on self-report, and we didn't want it to be, but unfortunately it was. And the other thing is, it was only tested in one-on-one delivery. When we developed Amigas, we developed it for either one-on-one, promotora to woman, or for group delivery, so promotora to group. We did not test it in the group setting because at the time, we didn't have enough money really to get the sample size that we would need for that kind of intervention, and we're hoping to do that in the future. So what we concluded from this is that a promotora-delivered intervention developed with input from the community can be effective in changing screening behavior. We would like to do more research on intervention versus promotora only. The interesting thing was when we did focus groups with the women at the end, after all of this had taken place, the one thing that always came out was, I was so happy that a promotora was willing to come and talk to me. And so we started to think, maybe it's just the promotora. Maybe it doesn't matter what the intervention is. So right now we're doing a test in Yakima with amigas, but we're doing amigas and promotora versus promotora just on her own without materials versus just the video, you know, that the woman just watches the video with no input at all, just to see what kind of differences we see there, because I feel strongly that the promotora is very powerful. Just like, I don't think she needs anything. She just needs to go, you know, and tell people stuff. But, of course, that would be sad for people like me because I like to develop interventions. But we'll see what happens with that. And we also would like to test this intervention in group settings. So we'd like to do an intervention test where we test individual one-on-one versus group. Because clearly, if it's just as effective in a group setting, it's going to be cheaper for promotores to deliver to a group of people. So that's sort of down the pike. The other thing we've just done is we've completed the administrator's guide for clinic administrators. It should be completed in the next month or two, after which CDC is planning to make this a best practices model that will be available on the CDC website, so people will be able to access it and use it in their settings. Do you have any questions? Yes.
Can you speak a little bit to the barriers between the participants giving consent to actually having their medical information be collected from you and the clinics not giving you that information? What were
the barriers? Well, some of the women actually went to private providers because that's more possible now with some of the insurance coverage. Now, most of these women didn't have insurance coverage, but for the ones who did, the private providers don't care if there's a signed HIPAA form. They want their own form. They have a form. And we didn't have that form because we didn't know who women were going to go to ahead of time. The other thing that happened, this was really a shocker to me. We have a clinic in El Paso that does, they do a clinic in a community center. And it's called the Socorro Ramirez Community Center. The name of the clinic, though, is Vida. So when women signed the HIPAA form, we asked them where they went for care, and the women said Socorro Ramirez, because that's where they went. But the people at the legal office at VIDA said, no, we're VIDA. And they didn't put VIDA. Well, I said, but you're the only people who do medical care at the Socorro Ramirez. They didn't care. So I think the legal departments are sometimes the problem because they're very particular. And when we have people fill out HIPAA forms, we generally ask them where they went. Well, you know, if they report something that's a little bit different from what the legal department wants, that's a problem. The other problem was Ciudad Juarez. I was surprised at the number of women. Of course, this was a little bit before all of the violence started to kind of escalate, but a lot of the women did go to Ciudad Juarez. And unfortunately, the records are not kept quite as well in the public hospital there, and they also don't recognize HIPAA forms. So that was really part of the problem. Yes.
Mm-hmm. That's from that the trust, and then where we think they should go, where is the best care. So we can do all the interventions, but it's just, where do you think I should go?
Mm-hmm.
And who will treat me, will respect, and where will the clock, and what day? That information gets them in.
Yes, yeah, I think you're right. One of the things we did do was to provide a list of providers, and for each provider, we told them what they would need to get access. So, for instance, they said, if I'm not documented, what do I have to have? You know, so we did have that information for them. But I do think you're right, the one-on-one, I think it's just really important in this particular population to have that kind of, you know, personal interaction. Okay, yes.
Yeah. I believe
that in our focus groups, the women understood and used cervica. Mm-hmm. So although they understood both terms, but that's the one that they most used.
Thank you.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.